Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, what's up? This is Seth Green, and you are listening to Somewhere in Vegas with Mark, and I am so hot, I would desperately like a glass of water. Please, please, give me some water.
This is Cindy Preston, and I'm with Mark on Somewhere in Vegas.
Hi, this is Melissa Peterman from CMT's The Singing Bee and the television show Reba, and I have to tell you, I just have to get it off my chest, I love Somewhere in Vegas with Mark.
Hi there. This is Faith Roscoe from General Hospital. You're listening to Mark on Somewhere in Vegas. And you better watch out. We know how to find you if you're not listening.
Hi, this is Shannon Egan from Whippet. And I love Somewhere in Vegas with Mark.
Hey, this is Lee Allen Baker with Somewhere in Vegas. Talking with Mark with a Q.
This is Courtney Cronin. You're listening to Somewhere in Vegas with your host, Mark. And I would make sure to listen every week because he's a sure bet.
Hey, this is the Money Man, Eddie Money. I've got two tickets to Paradise. And it's, you know what? It's Somewhere in Vegas. And what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas.
Hi, this is Crystal Gale, and I love Somewhere in Vegas with Mark.
Hi, this is Terry Nunn from Berlin, and you're listening to Mark Somewhere in Vegas.
Hi, this is Miracle Laurie from Joss Whedon's Dollhouse. There are three flowers in a vase, and I'm listening to Somewhere in Vegas with Mark.
Hi, this is Erin Hill, and you are listening to Mark on Blog Talk Radio and Somewhere in Vegas. Mark is a great guy.
Hi, this is Sean Pulaski. I'm still trying to figure out Mark Pico's sexuality, but I know you're listening to Somewhere Live in Vegas.
Here you go, Mark. I'm sorry. I thought you were she. I'm sorry. Get out of the tent. Let's get out of here.
Hey, this is Lance and Anna from Free Radio. And Anna?
And you're listening to Somewhere in Vegas.
Yes.
My favorite.
You know, that's usually what happens with me. I go to Vegas and I get lost, and so I end up somewhere in Vegas.
Somewhere in Vegas.
But I just don't know where it is.
Not quite sure.
Yeah, word.
Get ready. It's going to be hot. It's in Vegas. Check out Mark. Be there or be square.
Welcome to a special edition of Somewhere in Vegas. I'm Mark with a Q. I'm your host. I was privileged to be invited to the Sundance Film Festival this year. We were able to get some great interviews with some up-and-coming talent in all genres and aspects of film and television, and over the next couple weeks we'll be playing them for you. Today we're talking to two filmmakers making an impact at the Slam Dance Film Festival, which is running concurrent with the Sundance Film Festival. Before the amassing culture of people making YouTube videos, there was 30 Minutes of Madness, a TV show ahead of its time. In 1992, a group of friends decided to use a cable access show to perform comedic skits. The idea was revolutionary at the time, but was a secret outside the cast's native Detroit. The show ended after 14 episodes and the cast went their separate ways. The group got back together to shoot an episode on the 20th anniversary of the show. The movie, 20 Years of Madness, documents the reunion and how the group has changed over the years, but still creating their own brand of entertainment. The documentary brings back memories of the 90s as the MTV generation were growing up and changing the ideas of what entertainment and cultural significance was. It also shows how reliving a dream can be therapeutic to the drudge of everyday life. Our first interview is with Jerry White Jr., the director and producer of 30 Minutes of Madness and the main focus of the film. The second interview is with director Jeremy Royce.
Looking back, I mean, well, first of all, congratulations on Sundance. You know, was this something that you were really, you know, as you said, it was a 3 or 4 year process to make it to this point. Were you kind of surprised when you got the call?
I think surprise wasn't the feeling. It was like relief in a way. I mean, we were so, like, I knew that Slam Dance, you know, by filmmakers, for filmmakers. I was like, and I actually acted in a short film that played here 2 years ago and heard great things about it. So I was like, oh my God. But it was also a relief because it means people are going to see the movie. So it was like, yeah, I mean, I think it was all wrapped up, like surprise, relief, happiness, nervousness because we still had to do the mix and all this stuff. So I still haven't fully processed all the emotions.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're looking back at a time in the 90s where there was no YouTube. There was hardly any internet. And you have access to a cable show, basically. And there were other shows that were doing it, but, I mean, it's an interesting dynamic. You said it was a little bit different because you were local celebrities versus anything like that. I mean, can you kind of wrap up that experience a little bit?
Well, you know, like, we would hear about people seeing it in friends of friends, but it wasn't like we were constantly getting recognized on the street. However, it probably happened like 3 or 4 times, and those times it could have happened 100 times. Like, I remember being at a bowling alley and this girl coming up to me, "Are you Jerry White Jr.?" And I'm like, "Yes." She's like, "From 30 Minutes of Madness." And like, I didn't know her. None of my friends knew her. Like, she had no connection to our group. And I was just like, I felt like a fucking Humphrey Bogart. Like, I was a movie star in that moment. And it just shows you like how an audience, like one person, you know, can validate you in a way. You know what I mean? Like, we were satisfied having each other as our audience, but the fact that other people liked it too made it, just meant even more to us.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think the process itself seemed like, I think usually it looked like you guys had a lot of fun with the process and, you know, doing that. And then it got started getting a little bit serious at the end of there. Do you think that kind of was part of the demise of what 30 Minutes of Madness was?
It's possible. I mean, I think it was growing up. I think it was the fact that at first we could just turn on the camera and be zany and not really have much going on. And just the fact that we were editing it and putting in music satisfied us. But it wasn't just me. All of us felt like we wanted the next show to be better and the next show to be better. But that did create a dynamic where, you know, as soon as you try to make things a little more complicated, you have a script, you have locations, you have call times, and people are 19 and they go out drinking and they sleep in the next day. And those things started wearing on us, but I can't imagine it ever going a different way. That's why I say it couldn't have worked then, because we had to grow up. But we couldn't have, if we had stagnated and just continued to be satisfied with making funny faces, like, that wouldn't have been great either. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and, you know, like I said, it's kind of a new situation. It seems like the whole cast was very, very creative. You said it was a collaborative effort. Even up to now, we see a lot of these guys put their input in, musically, you know, through the script and all that as well. Working with creative types, I mean, now you kind of understand the situation you maybe had back then.
Yeah, I mean, it is, I understand that creative people were often very different, but I also feel like I have worked with people who are wildly imaginative, creative, but also responsible and can answer a phone and show up on time. So I don't think it necessarily means that creative means wild and unhinged. I think that you can have a happy medium.
You know, shooting in Detroit, you had mentioned that maybe if it was in L.A. or New York, you may have gotten a lot more traction with a lot more people. But, you know, using it as a background, as a set, it's really unique. Can you tell us a little about that?
Yeah. First of all, I love Michigan, except for harsh winters. And I even can enjoy those if I'm indoors. So I'm Michigan born and raised, and I love it. And I don't live there now, but I can see myself potentially living there again. So I'm a champion of Michigan, and I love Metro Detroit. So I actually go back and forth on this idea. I know that I and John say it in the movie, this idea of if we had been in New York or L.A. Sometimes I still think that. Sometimes I think, no, that's a cop-out. That's us blaming the city instead of us not being more working harder. So I don't know, but granted, of course, in the 90s and even now, you can't compare any city in America to New York or L.A. when it comes to filmmaking and television, you know? Even though Atlanta and some of these cities are coming up, it's still L.A. and New York. So do I think it could have been different? Maybe, but you know what? I love the unique voice of Michigan. There was never a question in my mind when we were doing a new show. Of course we're going back to Michigan. I see myself doing feature films, you know, in the future, hopefully, and I would love to shoot in Michigan. So, yeah, I think we get, there's so many movies with the same backdrop, right? It's the same city. It's L.A., it's New York, it's L.A. So I love the fact that Michigan has a lot of stories, and it's not just Detroit falling apart stories. You know, Detroit is one city. And first of all, I don't think it's falling apart. I think it is in a renaissance. It has its struggles. But it's one city. Michigan is huge, and there's all kinds of different. There's nature, there's other cities that are great. So, yeah, I love that place, and I love it as a backdrop.
And I want to mention that, 30mom.com, you guys can check out a lot of the old episodes but from back in the 90s. And like I said, you kind of guys were innovators before, you know, a lot of people. A lot of people are innovators and don't really realize it until, you know, something happens. So, I really look forward to seeing, hopefully we'll get to see some more of this documentary out there as well. So, anything else you want to add? Anybody want to thank?
No, again, thank you to Slam Dance. Thank you to Jeremy Royce for making a lovely film, and Joe Hornacek for coming, you know, out here. And I'm just looking forward to the future.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
And now, director Jeremy Royce.
Okay, Jeremy, I know that you're, maybe a decade younger than Jerry, but, you know, were you aware of what cable access was and kind of what they were doing there?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I grew up watching Saturday Night Live just like everyone else my age, I feel like. So we were all really aware of Wayne's World when it came out. So the first time that Jerry told me about the show, I was like, oh, right, it's Wayne's World. That's the common reaction. The big difference is this group of kids, they were teenagers. No one their age was doing public access at that time. They actually weren't allowed to. They had somehow managed to work their way in to make this show. And the age that they were at really reflected the tone of the program and added this youth and vibrance that, you know, I don't think you saw in public access often. Most of the time it was, you know, religious shows or sports shows, adults who wanted to dabble in filmmaking. And here you had these kids who really, like, just fell in love and put their entire heart and soul and all of their free time, which the free time you only have as a teenager, into this thing that they really loved and cared about. So although I wasn't involved with public access, I totally understood where they were coming from, and also had a similar love affair with filmmaking as a teenager, even though it wasn't, I didn't necessarily need a studio to do it because technology had evolved to a level that you could get your hands on the equipment you needed a lot more easily.
Yeah, the time, you talk a little bit about the time that this happened, and a lot of it deals with, you know, kind of where the MTV generation, where the MTV was moving away from music videos to doing reality programming and doing some off-the-wall stuff, as it were, and it seems like this is just ideal setting that they were right in the mix of it, if not kind of forerunners of what's been going on within the past decade. Can you tell us a little bit about, you know, kind of, you know, your reaction to, you know, first watching the show, and second, you know, kind of knowing that this happened in that time period?
Yeah, I mean, when you watch the show, it becomes really, really clear really early on that they weren't censoring themselves and that they were fully embracing the times. A lot of similar shows like Tim and Eric and Tom Green ended up actually breaking out after they'd already created their format and made a bunch of episodes. So it would be easy to say that they were sort of following this model, but they kind of evolved on their own organically. And it's really unique, and there's no single type of skit they did. It changed every episode. It was always involving new people. It was like this constantly evolving and growing circle of friends. And it was really, there's something really magical. Although the quality, you know, it's all shot on VHS for the most part, and they're teenagers who don't necessarily understand the craft of it. They weren't necessarily lighting, but they were writing skits. And there was almost a liberation because they didn't have those constraints that so many of us filmmakers now carry with us. They were free to do whatever they wanted, and that magic's really apparent in the show.
Having seen the cast and seeing a couple of the episodes before meeting the cast now, I mean, what was some surprises that you kind of, you know, found out through the process?
Yeah, I mean, I think I've worked with a bunch of the cast members in addition to Jerry on other projects before we started making this documentary. So I had my foot solidly within the circle when we began. But when I finally went back to Michigan and got to meet a lot of the guys who were there, the most striking thing for me was just seeing how comfortable and open they were. Like, I was expecting a lot of the subjects of the documentary are kind of off the map when it comes to having a support system and a network. A couple of them are homeless. One of them is a heroin addict, and a lot of them are pretty isolated. So when I showed up, I was worried about hitting a wall a little bit with them and not being able to really connect. And what I realized is as soon as you turn on those cameras, they all just come alive in a way that many of them even claim to. They haven't been like that in years. They haven't had that vehicle to interact with other people that way. And that was really surprising and encouraging. And that was probably the best part of the whole movie for me, was seeing these people open up and reconnect.
Yeah, it was almost like a coping mechanism for them, going back and doing this to a happier time, as it were, with the show and coming back to it. It seemed like that was what the case was, is that a lot of people were coming back and, kind of reliving their glory days, as it were, there as well. Another moral of the story kind of is that, you can go back home again, and kind of relive some memories if it's not too crazy or whatever. But tell us a little bit about that. What these guys evolving, and these guys basically going over and like I said, reliving their glory days and going through a situation where everybody had their troubles and their mental hurdles.
Yeah, I mean, I think it worked twofold. On one side, you could see a lot of these guys going back and finding that youth within them. I mean, our ongoing motto has been, it's never too late to be what you might have been. And I feel like that was the moral of the story, is that if you are lucky enough to have that community and you're still able to reach out to them, that it's as simple often as just going and putting yourself in the same situation to rekindle that enthusiasm that a lot of us lose over time as we sort of stop interacting the way we did as teenagers. And also, you see that when they go back and hang out, there's a lot of baggage that maybe was never resolved, that it comes up immediately as well. And that was a big part of the documentary, is seeing how these characters, who are all struggling in their own way, and who all sort of, their relationships blew apart in a ball of flames, how they work to overcome the years of resentment and the burnt bridges, and their commitment to this community in order to go through the work to do that. It was really inspiring.
You mean a lot of these people, they talk a lot about, what they were thinking back in the day and where they would be now. And we get to now, and looking back, some of them, didn't feel like they would be, if they're their teenage selves, they would be proud of themselves. What do you think about that situation? And some of these people, Jerry in particular, has evolved since that time. Can you tell us a little bit about, seeing them in the past and them now and their kind of reaction to that?
Yeah, I think it's twofold. On one side, it's about never giving up on the dream and chasing that dream. And it might not mean, forsaking your family and quitting your job and going off and becoming an artist, but finding a way to keep those passions that you had as a teenager in your life in some way. And on the other side, re-examining your idea of success and, like, looking at, as teenagers, I think we all imagine ourselves being somewhere else than where we end up, because it's just impossible to understand the complexities of life and the things that will unfold. But getting to a point where you can go back and reevaluate what success means to you, and find a way to make peace with the reality of adulthood, because it's really challenging and complicated. And I think that's what drives the film, is that a lot of our characters, their lives didn't turn out the way they wanted, but they're able to go back to this time when they were hopeful and tap into that and find some purpose and meaning, maybe not through what they're doing, but through the community that they're a part of.
Now, looking at the show now, I mean, obviously you guys have put it online, all that as well. We're in the midst of a YouTube culture, and Jerry had said this last night after the film, that he felt that we're right now drowning in a sea of, basically media and self-made stars, as it were. We can never kindle that time back in the 90s when people did have limited access, but they did, if they had access to a media format like a television, even if it's local, it did a lot. What's your opinion on that, the idea that right now we're kind of oversaturated a little bit in terms of people wanting to be stars?
Well, I think a big part of it is with the widespread availability of an audience through YouTube and Vimeo and online platforms, obviously there's a total oversaturation of the market. And I think we're about to reach a place where it's less about dumping your art in this wide sea to get lost, and we're starting to move in a direction where there's more of a curatorial process, the way there always has been with film festivals, where you can kind of find a home amongst other like-minded videos and reach your audience, even though there's a million other things. I just believe that in the coming years, there's going to be an opportunity for people to really find a home a lot easier, even than back then when there was limited access with television stations. I just feel like we're in this funny gray area, this middle ground, and it's just a different time, you know? I think there's a lot of huge advantages with the digital revolution and the access to equipment, and with those opportunities comes a lot more content. But I think if you make good content, I think we all believe, Jerry especially, that it's not about the medium. He shot on VHS, the most recent episode. It's not about the quality of your camera. It's about the quality of the story. And if you make a great story, it will find an audience somewhere, whether it's festivals or online or, you know, I guess we maybe are naive, but we believe that a good story will transcend the mediocrity.
Yeah, and this is a true art form, obviously, and not everybody's going to be Picasso. I'm interested to see as well. You know, I think it's absolutely great. You know, it was interesting for him to shoot on VHS. You know, I used to edit on VHS too. So it's a tough format, but it's really great to be able to see that they've kind of grown and they're carrying on a little bit more now. They've all kind of evolved a little bit through the process as well. So it's great to see that as well. Anything else you want to add?
I mean, I just want to reiterate how grateful we are to Slamdance for giving us this opportunity. It really is the perfect festival for our film, and we've, you know, had nothing but positive experiences and so many people coming up to us who get it. And it's a huge relief to know that there are other outsiders and weirdos who appreciate this struggle and share a lot of similar interests, and we're just really thankful for the opportunity to play opening night at Slamdance and be part of this great community in Park City.
Yeah, I mean, I said as a kid that grew up in the 80s and 90s, I'm very familiar with what kind of the format and everything like that. So it kind of brought me back. So if you're a Gen Xer, you're gonna love this movie. I can tell you that much. So thanks a lot for taking some time.
Thanks a lot.
Make sure to go to VegasPodcasting.com to listen to our past interviews, including Clay Chappelle from the movie Selma. You can follow us on Twitter at SWIV and Somewhere in Vegas on Facebook. Next Thursday at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern, we will talk to two women working to make an impact in the film industry, Jamie Natella from Blue Eyed Pictures and producer Janae Altschweiger. We'll see you guys next week.